For more episodes just like this one on a weekly basis, subscribe to RLRCPSolvers.com. You will not regret it.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Solvers. How are you, Robbie?
Rafraz, I only have one piece of feedback about the book, which is I don't think this line is in there.
Oh my gosh. Tessa, we're going to need some edits that.
Poor Tessa. Oh my God. Rafraz, what updates do you have about the book? I know there
well,
there's
you know,
one or two.
I had a moment right now of just pure gratitude. Like I was just sitting here thinking how lucky we are to know the people that we know who are so close to us in this space. And I just thought about Matt. You know, Matt created our website and Matt uploads every episode. And Matt is more honest and disciplined than RR ever
definitely.
Will be. And to have someone like that in your corner, which then made me think of Tessa.
Yeah.
Like someone who has just graduated from high school and is a better writer than either of us will ever be and took our book to heights we never thought imaginable. Yeah, so I'm just sitting here with like a smile and gratitude. And I think about our CP Solvers community, both those that are subscribed to RLR, but those who are not, and how lucky we are that they've been on this journey with us since 2019.
Do you have any doubt about that number, Profrez? You look like you're doubtful.
No, I don't. Is it, was it earlier?
2018.
Yeah,
December 11th, 2018, wow. Profrez.
Yeah. No,
so basically like 2019. Yeah.
You are incredible. You are incredible. And yeah, I think that we're going to definitely have a webpage and our RLR community will know before anyone. And in that webpage, there will be a sample chapter.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't do pre-orders on the paperback book, but we can do pre-orders on the Kindle version.
Nice.
The Kindle version we put for $9.99 because that's just, we want to get the sales up. But the paperback book is going to be $29.99. I'm still trying to figure out how I can get a discount code, if that's even possible or not. But I would love our RLR listeners to have some form of discount.
Yeah.
Tell us about the release date. And
May 20th, 2026. It's happening. You know why it's happening, Profrez? Let me tell these guys a story. So I was rounding today. I was so busy. It was post-call day. And I walk into round. I check my phone. I kind of like just clear. Nothing. No action. Emails clear. Text clear. I come out of rounds, and then writing notes and seeing some patients. I put my phone away. And then I come open my phone and I see 13 text messages and 21 emails in 3 hours. And all of them are from one person. And his last name is Manesh. And his first name is Prof. And his middle name is Reza. Or Rez. And you all have to know. You see us as a unified unit right here, presenting cases to each other in perfect symmetry and harmony, but we're not. We're very different people. Prof Rez has a very, very unique skill set of making things happen. I have never made anything happen in my entire life, except that when something happens, my job in this space is to sustain it. So up until the book is 10 years old, I will have played a microscopic role, but Prof Rez is a machine. Emailed 20 emails and many text messages. So the gratitude that I think all of us should feel, Prof Rez, especially those who are consuming this book, are really honestly to you and the innovator and the relationship builder that you are to bring these people together. But I think honestly, three other individuals develop a very, very concrete shout out from my vantage point. And that is Tessa, who I'm actually have a drafted email to, I haven't sent it yet, to connect with her and meet her finally virtually. And I probably have already sent that email by the time she's listening to this. And then the twins, Austin and Alec. I mean, their w contributions, which you'll see, are both emotional and really, really, really authentically powerful, practically powerful. So, yeah, I'm really, really excited for this book, Prophraz, May 20th, 2026. Really, really consider taking that little bit of a leap based on our existing relationship, and I think that once you go through it, you'll have those three individuals to thank, and then you'll want volume two. And just an FYI, Prophraz is already working on volume two. Sorry, Tessa.
Man, and I, my gratitude is to you. Like, I don't know who else I would email 20 times and text 20 times, not get a single response, and keep doing it as if nothing. And like, not only about the book, about random stuff. Like, it's not just the book. And then Robbie always goes through each of them and responds to everything. So I appreciate you,
Oh,
man.
that's not true, Prophra. Don't tell. I'm not that
I appreciate you. That being said, I have a great case for you and everyone. And actually, our last case, the hypercalcemia case,
Yeah, any
well, the one
updates?
before the facial cellulitis
Yeah.
case, I was talking to it with Dodmer, a medical student, and he loved that so much. And he created some figures and stuff.
That's
So
awesome.
I'm just so grateful for what we do. I mean, I put down my golf clubs. I hate golf now. It's caused so much stress. And now I'm finding my way back to reading. Like today, I was reading medicine, and I'm like,
Nice.
man, this is the right move. So let me share with you today's case. And our story, my friend, starts in the emergency department where you're just so familiar with. It's a 90-year-old man with metastatic prostate cancer, and he presents with 3 days of vomiting.
Right.
Actually, his wife is who brings him in, and his wife is helping him deliver a history and says some of those episodes looks like there's coffee grounds.
Yeah.
And during the past 3 days, really hasn't been taking in much, has had progressive weakness and multiple falls at home.
Yeah, very alarming constellation of symptoms, Prophraz. I think whenever something is coming out of a patient, a liquid is coming out of the patient, I think the priority is to make sure that it's not blood. And I want to tell you, I think the chances that this person has bleeding are very low. And let me make an argument as to why. So, whenever you're having upper gastrointestinal bleeding, which would be the no-miss diagnosis in somebody who's having coffee ground emesis, that upper gastrointestinal bleeding can declare itself in two ways. It can go down and trickle down and present as hematochezia, the very brisk upper GI bleed. More commonly, though, it presents as a trickle down slowly as melena. Unfortunately, for a subset of patients, they can also present with the exact same colors of liquid, coffee ground emesis, the upper GI equivalent of melena, and the oral version of melena, and then hematemesis, the oral version of hematochezia. So let's just take a moment to ask ourselves, what determines how the patient presents? And of course, if you have an upper GI bleed presenting as hematochezia versus melena, the main distinction is velocity of bleeding. So how fast you bleed, if you bleed slowly, melena, if you bleed fast, hematochezia. But I don't think we've ever really spent time on talking about what determines which way the blood comes. You're having an upper GI bleed. Why do some people vomit it up? And why do others deliver it down to the rectum and anus? And the answer is velocity. If you are having an upper GI bleed present as something that the patient vomits up, it's brisk. It's so brisk that it overcomes the stomach's capacity to continue to deliver it downwards. So you get functionally a gastric outlet obstruction, not from actual obstruction, but from overwhelming the stomach. It is why, if you drink 12 liters of water a day, you will overwhelm the kidney and get consequences of that water, even though the kidneys are working fine. You will get psychogenic polydipsia-induced hyponatremia, same concept. So While you have to be very open to the possibility that this person who is saying to you that he's vomited coffee ground emesis, for him to do so for 3 days and not be in extreme distress creates a disconnect between how much bleeding he should have had to where he is now. Now, if you told me 3 hours, ooh, I would be very worried. But the fact that he's been able to tolerate so much vomiting for 72 hours really creates enough of a disconnect that I'm no longer panicking, but I'm not shutting the door on a morbid hypothesis. So, what would I do next, Prof. Rez? I think I would really remind myself that this analysis is imperfect and a morbid diagnosis is still before us. So I would still presume this is an upper GI bleed, but my additional test probability is actually on the lower side. And I'm hoping for him that that's not the case.
Dude, that's so eloquent because I think that sort of reconciles something in our mind. And I hate to put a spoiler, but I want to
No.
share that spoiler because
Please.
this, I think, like pushes us towards thinking that coffee ground was a consequence of something else. So when he was examined in the emergency department, frail but hemodynamically stable. There's only one finding, Robbie, on exam. And that's when you looked at his lip, there was a laceration.
I see.
And his hemoglobin was 1 point below its normal level. It was at a 9 as opposed to a 10. And this is where the sort of spoiler is that we're like, well, could that coffee ground have been him just swallowing blood from the bite on his lip? And I think you just made a huge argument that that, in fact, is more likely the scenario that then something deep inside is just open and oozing.
I mean, I think that there are some small exceptions to coffee ground emesis being a large GI bleed, and it's when the GI bleed is proximal. So you'll see patients with esophageal bleeding or esophagitis. Esophageal bleeding, essentially from esophagitis, get nauseous and vomit it up. Yeah, I think any proximal bleeding, including in the lip, can do it too. Yeah, so I think Prof. Rez, I think just yeah, for all of you to continue to study. When somebody is truly vomiting up blood, unless they have another reason to vomit, you can presume that the vomiting is as a result of the stomach being overwhelmed by a tremendous amount of blood. And that tremendous amount of blood declares itself very quickly in some pretty sinister consequences. So if you take all comers, upper GI bleed and lower GI bleed are equally morbid. And there's plenty of data to suggest that if you take all patients with a GI bleed, you can just bleed briskly. But if you filter patients with an upper GI bleed presenting as vomiting or hematochezia, you have a subset of patients who are incredibly morbid. That subset is rare because it's diluted by the sheer prevalence of patients with upper GI bleed presenting with melanoma. And to give you some rough numbers that I haven't studied in like a year or two, patients with GI bleed, about 80 to 90% of them present with melanoma. And it's the other 10 to 15% who are either presenting with hematochezia or hematemesis or coffee ground emesis. Those are the people that are very, very sick. So the overall population of upper GI bleed has equal morbidity to lower GI bleed, but if you apply a filter to those presenting not as melanoma, they should be very, very, very sick. And so for him to do this for 3 days, that doesn't add up.
So my mind is blown right now. Let me just try to restate this and tell me if it's correct or not, but
For
be
sure.
honest. But you're saying there's two scenarios where you have vomiting in the context of blood that's in the stomach, whether it originated there or was swallowed there. One is that that blood is actually causing the irritation, and that irritation, because it overwhelms the capacity of the stomach, it's not emptying, it just is too much of an insult and causes the patient to vomit. Or alternatively, the patient is vomiting for another reason that's unrelated, which has huge implications. Or is that really how we have to be thinking about the, and in this case specifically, the fact that we do have an alternative source being the bite, would you be framing him more as someone who is vomiting, not because of brisk bleeding, but vomiting for something that we haven't identified
Yeah,
yet?
exactly. You have work to do. You have work to do. So what does Hallett and Mallory Rice present? Mallory Rice says you're vomiting for other reasons. You have a little tear in your distal esophagus, and then you start to get blood, and then maybe cough some coffee ground emesis. A classic example of how the vomiting is often because of alcohol use, and alcohol is a specific mechanism why it predisposes to Mallory Rice. Separate reason for vomiting. And then you have a little bit of bleeding. And that's possible for sure. But the initial focus is, oh my God, vomiting. Most people, Mallory Weiss tear esophagitis are much less common than peptic ulcer disease, esophageal varices. Those people, if they those people are bringing up their blood, it means, why don't you just imagine? So you have a boom, a varix that pops, okay? And the bleeding is into the stomach, right? Blood does not, blood, there's nothing inherently nauseous about blood. We know that because we know many people let their blood go down, right? So what has to happen for the stomach to decide to be like back up against gravity?
Right.
Only one reason. It has no other option. It's full, completely full. And that's why those patients are in serious trouble. You know that they are, so you're hoping there's another mechanism for the emesis. And
Wow.
when the patient survives 3 days, you know for a fact, basically, with some humility, that there's another mechanism for the nausea. You cannot survive a GI bleed of that volume for that long. Yeah.
Thank you for that. So in the emergency
Yeah.
department, the patient says they want to leave, that they don't want to stay.
Yeah.
And any reflection or thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me show you the door and let's walk as we go there. Let's talk as we go there. Yeah, I do that on purpose, Prof, because so there's actually there's two reasons why I do exactly that. The first is if you can walk out of an emergency room, you're fine. Truly, if you can walk, which means you need to get up, use your cardiovascular system, you need to be able to actually make it to the bathroom without vomiting all over the floor. Like if you can actually make it out of the emergency room, you're fine. The other reason is I want to remind people that this is a hospital, not a jail, that I cannot stop you unless you don't have capacity. And if you don't have capacity, odds are you're not going to be able to navigate your way through an uncertain place without assistance. So you're not going to be able to make it out of the emergency room. Odds are. Some people, unfortunately, there are some exceptions, and you have to be vigilant to that possibility. A 90-year-old man, unlikely. And so as we walk, I'm aligning myself and reminding myself that you are telling the person that you're in charge, and I'm not putting any resistance. And you have a much more compelling case to make an argument to come back. And this happens to me maybe once a month where somebody who has heart failure, who's like, hey, doc, I'm leaving. I don't care. This is not working for me. And we try to walk out. It doesn't work. They can't do it. It's impossible. But also it really creates a nice conversation where I'm literally escorting them out the door. And it's my elevator pitch to say, hey, what do I need to tell you? And so, yeah, if he can make it to the door, and I kind of share with them, hey, just as a reminder, I'm here for you 24/7. If you decide to come back, please come back. Is there anything that you're particularly rushing to do or anything I can help you with? But not standing there blocking his exit. Walk with him. So yeah, that's what I would do.
I love that. So I'm not sure what they did, but they
Yeah.
declared that he had decision-making capacity,
Yeah.
discussed the risks, and he was discharged. So he gets discharged. And then what happens is that over the next day,
Yeah.
his wife notices that he's more and more confused, like not able to communicate with her, doesn't know what he's doing, unsteady on his feet. And that prompts her to bring him back to the emergency department. And so he comes back to the emergency department and still hasn't really consumed much in terms of food, is still having nausea, some emesis, and gets some labs. His hemoglobin is pretty stable, Robbie. But what comes back surprisingly on the labs is that his sodium is 120, serum sodium. Did you want additional lab value in terms of the sodium, or do you want me to pause for a second to let you reflect on that?
Yeah, I'll share with you the reflexive. The only other additional point you want to make sure is that you don't have hyperglycemia causing you to overthink about the sodium.
Yes. Yeah.
So I know you would have told us if his sugar was low, but that just practice for everybody. You can analyze this problem and as very likely true hyponatremia. And yeah, I think we have so many schemas on hyponatremia. So I won't sit here to convince you that the real problem that you are trying to diagnose is hypoosmolarity. And Profres, here's hyponatremia in a fundamentally simple way. We know that there's too much free water in the blood. You can only get too much free water in the blood if you are drinking too much. And too much is directly in proportion to two things. One, how much your kidneys are excreting. If your kidneys are working perfectly well, you can drink up to 12 liters of water a day. But if you have a poor GFR, or if you have ADH on board, dramatically reducing your kidney's ability to excrete free water, you now are restricted to less and less and less fluid before it's too much. So the first thing you want to know in a patient who's hyponatremic is you know for a fact that he's drinking too much free water. And the question is, at what threshold is too much for him? So you need to study his renal free water clearance. And the way to do that is to study the ultimate determinant of clearance for everything, which is what is his GFR. If he has chronic kidney disease and his GFR is 10 or 15, his capacity to excrete free water will be dramatically diminished, so he may be getting water toxic at a much lower number. The other thing that you have to study is how much he is eating. Because ultimately, drinking too much water and putting too much water in your system is not just a function of how much water you excrete, but the concentration of the solution that you put in your body. So if you drink nothing but water all day long, you're putting in pure water into your system and you're going to get water toxic at a much lower number. But if you mix water with electrolytes, with protein, with food, the solution that you are pouring into your body is now more and more and more concentrated. And so naturally, you can handle more and more water if you eat more and more food. So hyponatremia is a fundamental, simply problem. You have too much water compared to too much solute. And you can do that to yourself with perfect kidneys by not eating enough in relation to how much water you're drinking. Or you can do that because your kidneys are not healthy in terms of water capacity. So what would I want to know right away, Profres? I would want to know what his GFR is, because if he has chronic kidney disease, he's already vulnerable. And then the other thing I would want to know is what is his ability to excrete free water? And a good place to ascertain his ability to excrete free water is his urine osms. However, his urine osms may contain a large amount of ineffective osms that don't participate in free water clearance. So a much better proxy of his urine free water clearance is his urine sodium and his potassium times two. Now, none of that information is immediately actionable right now. He has a sodium of 120 and he's nauseous and he's confused. The question is this symptomatic hyponatremia? I would say that I would understand why somebody would call this symptomatic hyponatremia, but I think that a sodium of 120 is unlikely to be the sole contributor to somebody being this confused. He might be this confused because he has another acute process going on, but at the age of 90, he's probably mostly confused because his tolerance for a threshold is much lower, which means that the urgency to fix the sodium is not that urgent. Because just because he's more sensitive to it doesn't make it more of an emergency. So what would I do, Profres? I would probably give him 500 cc's of normal saline because he's been vomiting a lot. And I would collect all the data that I need to collect, especially his urine, to understand how to help him next. And I would make him NPO because you can't get hyponatremic if you're not drinking anymore. Yeah.
That was superb, man. I'm gonna have to re-listen to that. That was poetry. I did get a little nervous because Gino, any household that has two cats has a princess, which is Sydney, and has a criminal demon that the Republicans campaign on, and that's Gino. He just woke up, so I'm nervous. He's about to go request trickling water from the
Oh
bathtub or the
no. Uh-oh.
sink.
All right, I gotta move it along,
No,
Prophet.
you don't. No, he's fine. I'm just so impressed by your discussion right now. Not only because you're just really on the right track, but you also made me realize that it was the bite of the lip, not something happening in the stomach. That was really cool. So I'm going to give you the data that we have. The serum osmosis is low. The glucose is normal. The urine sodium is less than 10, very low. I don't have a urine potassium, but the urine osmosis is also low
Okay,
at
great.
125. And this was all collected before fluid was given.
Beautiful.
He was given 500 cc's, and his sodium went from 120 to 130, and his confusion and nausea did not improve.
So the urine osms here being low tells you that his renal clearance capacity is actually excellent. And so the only reason that he's getting hyponatremic is there's an imbalance between how much he's drinking and how much he's eating. And given his situation, his nausea and vomiting, it tells you just how little caloric intake he has. And I would say I'm probably stereotyping, but I can imagine a very loving, adoring partner who is trying to get fluids in him. And is probably being successful at hydrating him, but unfortunately unsuccessful at getting actual solid food in him as the driver for his imbalance. And now the question is, why is she having such difficulty getting food in him, and why is he nauseous? And so the root of the issue has not yet been discovered. The root of the issue is nausea and vomiting that has resulted in a selective pouring of water without nutrition, causing him to have an imbalance in his body. His kidneys are doing the best they can with a great excretion capacity, but they've been overwhelmed by the disconnect. This has been proven by the fact that when you pour in a slightly hypertonic solution, his problem vanishes. And so now the good news is you don't have to worry about osmotic demyelination syndrome because you should do some reading about that. This correction is great. It's perfect. Anything less than 12 is totally fine. And now the question is, why is he not eating? And I think that we'll have to explore.
So Robbie, he gets a CT scan and I'm at home. And then the next day I'm come to the hospital, I see that he is upgraded to the step down unit. And the CT head shows a bilateral subdural hematoma, no mass shift. Yes, and I'll pause there.
Unfortunately, Prophet has I can't tell you the number of times I've been humbled by a subdural hematoma. I think I would not be surprised if any of these things are true. That he had a trauma and nobody knew it. That he's on an anticoagulation and didn't have any trauma. Or, as is true for subdurals, nothing has ever happened to him and there's no good reason why he has this. The bilateral nature of the subdural hematomas really suggests. Really opens up the possibility to a spontaneous event. It's hard to imagine an unwitnessed trauma event that results in bilateral subdural that isn't severe and prominent and doesn't leave a scar on the patient's body. I wouldn't be surprised ultimately whether this event is potentially a consequence of him violently vomiting and nauseous. And so I think the most likely sequence of events is something happened to him. He got a subdural hematoma and now he's nauseous. But I would actually also be open to the possibility that the subdural hematomas are a consequence of something happening that's causing him to be nauseous as well. So it's difficult. I think the good news that the lack of mass effect gives you time. I think what I would do in real time is I would revisit his medication list for anticoagulants. I would call neurosurgery. He will likely need an interval scan 6 hours from now to make sure they're not progressing. They will likely recommend anti-seizure medications, which will be tricky because they tend to make people nauseous. But in my back pocket, I'm thinking, have I really gotten the sequence of events here? And the sequence events right now on the surface are bilateral subdural hematoma causes a predictable nausea syndrome that's causing everything else. The question is, why does he have bilateral subdural hematomas? And if there's a clear inlet into that, like trauma, done. But there isn't a clear inlet, then you might have to go back and say maybe the nausea caused violent retching of the bridge and veins. And why is he nauseous is the original question. So this case may seem like it's tucked, and it could be if you get a good history for the subdurals, but it may be an open thread still.
I absolutely fabulous. His wife, there's two things I think will help us deliver a coherent story. One is just time. By the time I saw him, it was my first time meeting him. He was no longer nauseous. He was like eating. He was no longer confused, totally with it. He did get that interval scan at 6 hours. There was no, enlargement. It was very subtle. Like I couldn't even see the subdural. I went to the exact slice. I don't know if that to think that something I can't even see, I went to the slice already, I can cause this much nausea, perhaps. I don't know. But the wife does tell us that he is frail and he's been having some episodes of falls that have
Oh,
been
you mentioned that.
unwitnessed.
Sorry.
But to your point, superficially on the head, there's no bruising. There's no, like the radiologist will say, oh, there's like this area of bruising on the CT scan. So I'm not sure. I would love to hear how you put everything together. But what I can tell you is that within a day, no longer nauseous, joking around, all
Beautiful.
his labs improved, and he wasn't on any blood thinners, and yeah, he looked remarkably well.
No symptoms, no problem, Prof. Yeah, I had a very similar story of a gentleman who came in who was in the lobby of his building, and the front desk folk were just so frustrated about noticing him being increasingly confused over the last 3 months. So he came in and he was billed as a patient who was getting demented. He's 90. And so he just needs placement. So Prof, as I see him, he looks like he is chronic unkempt and whatnot, and looks like he has a dementia syndrome. So I call medicine team and, hey, I can't place him. And I said, hey, sorry, he hasn't gotten his head CT yet. But he'll get it on the way up before he goes to the floor. And I got a call from the radiologist that he has a massive right side of subdural with mass effect. Unfortunately, despite draining it, he had no improvement really, because he does have a predictable base rate, 50% of 90-year-old dementia syndrome. But a massive symptomatic contributory mass effect subdural slipped under my radar completely. It is so, probably the most humbling diagnosis in medicine, if you ask me, of just how, even more than PE, is of how it can sneak up on you. So yeah, I've been in this situation before, and I'm glad he's fine. I'm glad his subdurals are stable and not progressing. And gosh, the hard part for the family is, what do you do to make sure this doesn't happen again? I don't know.
The two things that impressed me most, because like RLR is bread and butter. Sometimes there's exotic diagnoses. When the patient said coffee ground, almost everyone reflexively was like GI scope as the main next step. But you sniffed that. You were like, wait a minute. I'm not discounting the coffee ground. I'm not discounting that it could be something morbid, but who has like a severe bleed and just hang out for 3 days? Like that. I mean, it's just such high level dissecting of a case. And we have such a good alternative explanation being the bite. And it really reframes it as, hey, it's not so much bleeding within the GI tract, but likely there's another cause of vomiting that we need to explore. Maybe that would have prompted a CT scan of the head as opposed to an upper endoscopy that we all reflexively, including myself, were going down. So I want to just commend you on that. Not condemn, but commend you on that. And then the second thing you did, the sodium. How easy would it be to see the sodium of 120 and reflexively say that's the cause of encephalopathy and shut the door? But you said, wait a minute, I'm not yet ready to, dismiss that the possibility that there's something else contributing. It's only a sodium of 120. There's other reasons that he's hyponatremic from it, and we haven't even answered why he's nauseous. And so I think like everything, like the nausea, the eventual encephalopathy, no doubt that the sodium may be contributing.
For
There was
sure.
another factor. And so I guess my last question to you is, how do people get to that level of sniffing and not being victim to the first abnormality to falsely explain the patient's presentation while there's something, in the background that really needs to be answered?
I have bad news for you and everyone, preference. I still make horrific mistakes. In fact, I was part of a peer review where my group and my peers said that the care that I delivered was not the standard of care to a patient. 10, 11 years out, it still happens. And it's going to happen to everybody. So I think ultimately, Profess, my message to everybody is that one that you're not ready to care for patients independently and completely when you graduate your training in whatever program in medicine, and as a PA student, as an NP student, as a resident. You're never ready. You are always, always, always have something to learn and grow from no matter what. And so how do you get that good progress? I mean, I think that ultimately the truth is that the opportunity for you to be better and better and better in medicine is present until the day you retire. And even on the day you retire, you're going to regret retiring because you could have learned something tomorrow when you go and hit up the golf course again, finally. So yeah, ProfRes, it's really hard news. What everybody is doing here by dedicating themselves to buying the book on May 20th, by dedicating themselves to learn to these episodes, it should be required. And in fact, it is. You get CME, you have to continue to learn and grow. But for me, the way I push myself is through this format, ProfRes. See cases, present them to you, learn from you. And there's no other way. If you just stay status quo after residency or training, you're delivering suboptimal care, I guarantee it.
I just want to say that was just so cool for me to witness in real time. Like you just sniffing those things that it's so easy to, it's almost like that radiographic consolidation to just be like, oh, it's pneumonia, let me give antibiotics,
yeah, totally.
As opposed to correlate clinically. But even this stuff, like sodium, correlate clinically.
Yeah.
Vomiting, correlate clinically. Or maybe we could say correlate robbly.
Tell the peer review committee that.
That's a wrap, folks.